two people regarding the homework and regarding the interview. So let me start from the very beginning. Ruben sent me two emails because the questions he asked me are very, very interesting and very good from the point of view of conduct spectrum researches. I will start from there. Thank you, Dennis. The question is, in our second homework, we calculate the spectrum of the antiferromagnet magnet, at least around the ground state. But if one makes the rank of the result, one sees that the velocity with the omega over decay is not zero at the brilliant A. So then the question is, I remember that that was always used to be the case. Isn't it with? So I didn't understand what was used to be the case, that the group velocity is zero or not zero. From your point of view, the group velocity on the edge of the brilliant zone should be zero or non-zero?
Zero.
Non-zero.
Zero.
Okay. Zero. Let's consider one dimensional brilliant zone and write down the dispersion for phonons, like you would do from my class. Omega equal to 2cm square root of 1 minus cosine ka. So this is the dispersion law. Well, forget about the coefficient of proportionality for the excitations in one-dimensional chain of atoms that interact with each other by means of harmonic one. So at k equal k near zero, so the dispersion is linear, right? So on the edge of the brilliant zone, what do we have? We have the omega over decay. This is the group velocity. And if we take the derivative, we will see that it is proportional to the sine of Ka. So if K is equal to plus minus pi over A, then the group velocity is zero, right? So for what do we have looking at this picture for magnets? For example, one-dimensional magnets. In a ferromagnet, we have Ks, Z, well, Z is equal to 2 in one dimension, but anyway. For ferromagnets, we have this thing, 1 minus cosine Ka. For anti-ferromagnet, we have this, square root of 1 minus cosine Ka. So if you differentiate this with respect to K, then you will have sine of Ka in the numerator. So if you substitute K is equal to plus minus pi over A, you will also have zero. So for magnets, the group velocity, at least in one dimensional case, is also zero on the boundaries of the brilliant zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's absolutely normal. So you can see that the dispersion laws between phonons and magnons have many common features.
Oh, but the thing at the homework, that was not.
Is it, you asked me the question that is not related to homework, but I'm answering.
Not really. Wait.
The question about group velocity was not related to homework, but it's an interesting question.
No, but when I calculated based on what I got from the homework, it was not zero. Well, it was two-dimensional, right?
Two-dimensional.
And if I take ky equal to zero,
If you take ky equal to zero, okay, then.
Then I got non-zero group velocity at the bottom.
Then you get non. Okay. For two dimension. But isn't it what you are having for four norms in two dimension as well?
Maybe. I don't know.
So let me tell you the general comment about all this. The group velocity and its behavior near the boundaries of the Brillouin zone is not particularly important for physical properties at low temperature, because these describe quite high lying excitations. Of course, for the ferromagnets, omega is zero, and there. For anti-ferromagnets, omega is zero near k equal to zero, as well as for ferromagnets, but where k is equal to plus minus a, you have that omega is equal j proportional to j with some prefactor. So what is important? It is important that omega behaves as some power of k around certain points in the Brillouin zone, and these points contribute to thermodynamic quantity. The behavior of the group velocity is not that important, because group velocity plays the role in scattering, as you indicated. So I guess the question, if the group velocity is zero for some case, will this spin wave scatter? The answer is no. They will not scatter, and they not even move. The corresponding wave packets will not even propagate. But this is not important, because such magnums or phonons or whatever will nevertheless undergo decay on other phonons. If they don't scatter these, their lifetime is really, really short, because they will undergo decay as a result of interaction with other phonons or magnets. So whether their group velocity is zero or not zero, small or large, does not have principal meaning for the description of physical properties. So at low temperature, and only this case, what matters, the main contribution to physical properties comes from the points where omega is very, very small. And one can show that such excitations are also have long duration of life. So basically, the scattering of probability of excitation, say, of this sort is really very, very small. So these excitations simply live longer and thus contribute to thermodynamic quantity. Yes.
The question about your formula for omega for the anti-ferromagnet.
Uh-huh.
I think from like our notes and stuff, we had 1 minus cos squared in the square root, I mean.
For you have gamma k. You have
1 minus gamma k squared. In the square root.
So it's cos squared over 2.
I have rewritten this for one dimension. So gamma k squared. So wait, one second, let me briefly share this. Thank you. Omega k, so this is for anti-ferromagnetic from your homework. It is 4JS, the derivative 1, minus gamma k squared, where gamma k, right, is equal to 1 half of cosine kx plus cosine ky, right? So, okay, then for problem for one dimension, if it is one dimension, then you have to have here cosine squared. Okay. So let's check. 1 minus, thank you, cosine squared a equal to, so first of all, 1 minus 1 plus. Over to you. And it gives you, It gives you the linear dispersion for omega. It should be cosine squared.
Okay.
Thank you very much. This is exactly. When you answer the question, then during the interview, you don't have to remember the exact coefficients before the square roots. So just say that magma dispersion has this square root for anti-ferromagnets and this thing for the ferromagnets. Now, one more question from Ruben. Since I pronounced his name, I'm sorry. In the homework, we calculated the ground state energy of the anti-ferromagnets. Interestingly enough, this energy is lower than the classical ground state. The correction is negative. Is this not anomalous? Is our approximation, that of the Holstein-Kronenkopf bosons, perhaps not compatible with the vanishing incubation number in Fourier space? Is our approximation in Fourier space for some odd reason? Is our approximation perhaps not compatible with the vanishing incubation number in Fourier space for some odd reason? So concerning the ground state energy from Holstein-Kronenkopf approach, the answer is there is no theory that states whether the correction of the first order or any subsequent orders should be positive or negative. The important thing that it should be small. I asked that question myself when I did research on the related problem on triangular lattice and isotropic anti-ferromagnets on triangular lattice. So the answer to the question is that the correction can have any size. In any set. And moreover, when you generate the expansion in powers of 1 over 2s, well, first of all, in reality, you cannot go very far. You can go at best up to the third order calculating sublattice magnetization and up to the second order in 1 over s calculating other quantities. So this, but when you, in practice, generate this series, then this series will be asymptotic. It's not even convergent. It's not even convergent, so because this is approximate. Typically, the series that I used in expansion in condensed matter problems with respect to some small parameter are asymptotic. and may not be even convergent at all, because the numerical coefficient before powers in the next index approximation may grow fast enough. So, and we cannot say anything about the science of those corrections. What really matters is not whether quantum fluctuations will increase or decrease the ground state energy. What matters is the behavior of sublattice magnetization. This is the key quantity what people look at when they assume the classical ground state. So that is for magnetization. So it is equal to S minus Ni. They calculate the averages of this thing up to the necessary order in 1 over 2. If your Hamiltonian has many parameters, many interactions, then it can be quite a complicated function. And they see where on the phase diagram this thing turns to zero. If somewhere it turns to zero, then this is the matter of concern. This suggests that our initial assumption that the classical ground state is valid is actually wrong. And people have to employ other methods, other approaches. And there are many approaches other than Holstein-Primakov. So Schwinger spin density wave approach, so Schwinger boson approach, so sort of spin density wave, Schwinger boson approach, then fermionic representation. Then one can introduce Majorana fermions to write down the Hamiltonians. So people employ other complementary approaches trying to see whether classical ground state is destroyed at approximately the same range of parameters or not. So, but the value of the ground state energy is not what people look at, and don't ask the questions about the what sign, what correction. Okay. Then I will go here to. And another email. So the student asked was concerned about the apparently length or the list with the questions for the interview. So my friends, in fact, I have to tell you that you have any sentence here implies that you have to write just a couple of four formulas and say. Two, three, four sentences related to this. So this is really simple. You don't have to go in anything in detail. So the method of interview will be really just aims at the discussion. So the atmosphere will be relaxed and nothing else. Yes.
To be clear, these are not my emails anymore. Right?
There is nothing to be concerned about. What I would advise to look at, week three. At week three, check tutorial six and the corresponding formulas. And remember the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Gross-Pitayevsky, I would like you to remember the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, that the expression for the current. What happens if you substitute the wave function of the condensate into this current? Then the question said, how can the excitation spectrum be derived from the time-dependent Gross-Pitayevsky equations? For example, many questions here, how can the excitation spectrum be derived? You should just say in a couple of sentences, we substitute this into this and do the algebra. Of course, if time permits, I can ask you to do some of the steps of the algebra on the board. But if the question says, how can the excitation spectrum be derived, then you should indeed say how it should be derived. But by the way, this question, how can the excitation spectrum be derived from the time that Dostoevsky was considered from the lectures on quantum field theory 1? It's not here, so then there is a sometimes overlap of the condensed matter lectures. We can try to subside with whatever that is equal to. So this is the Dostoevsky equation. So it is written with respect to, in fact, classical field phi. Classical field phi and the derivative, but the whole physics of superfluidity, all of the whole physics, was actually a too strong thing. A good amount of physics can be obtained using this nonlinear equation. So vortex lattice, then excitation spectrum of the system of weakly interacting bosons, then the behavior of the wave function of the wave function of the condensate near the vortex core, and apparently many more things. So you can even study whether the agricose of vortex lattice, how it moves in, or how it moves, say, for example, if you apply electric field, so you can add the external potential and can study feeding of vortices. So quite many things can be studied using this equation. So it is written in the for the neutral liquid, bosonic liquid. So this is the system of the helium 3. Because I didn't add the term with the vector potential. This is the simplest situation. Then it is written in the absence of external potential V of X. And if you add this potential, then this equation describes the dynamics of the condensate, for example, in the system of trapped cold atoms.
Yes, that's true.
So if the question asks, how can the excitation spectrum be derived from the Dostoevsky equation, you just say that in equilibrium, the solution of this Dostoevsky equation is the following. It's just the square root of the density of the particles in the condensate times the term with the constant phase. Here phase is independent on either space or time. This is the equilibrium solution, call it phi naught. Then what happens if we perturb this system? If we perturb this system, then this theory having the derivative with respect to time and with respect to space will presumably admit some kind of the solution if linearized, having the character of the plane wave. So we will write phi as a function of x, comma t, equal to phi naught plus. So phi and if it is very important, is a complex scalar field. It has amplitude and phase. So the correction to this field must be complex as well. So we will arrive. We will see the solution in the following form. Phi naught plus u times e to the power I omega k minus, omega t minus k x plus its complex conjugate e to the power minus I omega t minus k x with the minus sign. And treat u and u dagger as an independent parameter. So we linearize this equation with respect to u and u dagger, assuming them small, and obtain the system of two linear coupled equation. And if we solve this system, this will give us the dispersion law, omega of k equal to 2, the following square root, k squared over 2m. So we can, if we set h bar equal to 1, times k squared over 2m plus 2g rho naught. If we do the algebra and when you prepare this question, I would like to advise you still to do this this algebra, this seeking the correction in this work. And if you write down Bogomolov-Rostropovsky equation and other Hamiltonian, you can set h bar equal to 1. Otherwise, it will be too much. You get this dispersion, and then you say a simple thing that for small k, omega of k will be proportional to k forms for large k, omega of k will just display the behavior of the dispersion law of the free particle. The physical argument behind this is very, very simple. So if k is large enough, then physically the particles, if their interaction is weak enough, can be considered as not interacting and not scattering one with respect to each other. Right. If k is small, then their particles, the interactions are important, and the particles feel each other, scatter strongly, and this results in the dispersion law that is identical to that of fermions. So we deal with the propagation of fermions in bosonic liquid, better to say, bosonic gas with the interacting particles. Because strictly speaking, of course, this writing this equation assumes that particles are weakly interacting. And this is what we indeed have to assume to build up a sense of theory. Well, I'm just giving you an example what you should write in part of this. So nothing extraordinary if you miss a sign or say efficient light.
Just to clarify, so everything you've written up on that list will go through basically all of them in the time frame.
I can ask you, for example, one question out of the list of two, and can ask you something else. But the thing is, you the simplicity of this Fourier process is that it, despite the fact that you see many equations and the list is long, you should see only two, three sentences. You just write one, two, four formulas per equation. I deliberately decided to make this list clear. And of course, this is the result of this is that the list is long. So I don't want to write the questions for you, say, in a very abstract way, say, Magnus, force or vortices, because one can talk about vortices innumerable amount of time. It's a very broad topic. If I tell you, but interacting with both the gas, the question will be even what to start. Just another example. Another example.
Actually, two questions. They said strong interactions in which, or stronger relatively interactions in which case?
There are two parameters, right? Yeah.
When you were talking about small k or large k, in one case you mentioned interaction between particles, and in the other case, I believe you said there's a connection up.
Well, if k is large, then the energy of the Fourier particle is large compared to this membrane. Large k, I mean k squared over 2m is much greater than 2g times rho naught. For small k, k over 2m is much smaller.
And also, in your step from phi naught to phi that's below it,
yes.
I believe you said this was a perturbative system. Would you clarify what you mean and how you get from saying we perturb the system to the expression with the exponentials? You mentioned the complex part. You explained complexity, but I'm still not certain why there are those particular exponentials in that. And again,
so
what you mean
we
by
we see there we assume typically we expect that the linearized equation, linearized process energy equation, will have the solution in the form of three waves. So the perturbation. The perturbation to the solution that minimizes ground state energy should be sorted in the form of three waves. This is our expectation. So low-lying excitation in which we're interacting both gas will have the character of waves. So there's the similar situation we have when we consider the excitations on top of ferromagnet or anti-ferromagnet. So low-lying excitations should have the form of the free waves, and thus we should seek the solution in this problem. Mm-hmm.
What's the importance for this spectrum in the condensate?
Okay. The importance of this spectrum is that when we have the gas, right? When we have the gas of particles, bosons in this case, then and if they are not interacting, and gas implies that the particles do not interact, we have this dispersion. But when the particles interact, we strictly speaking have not gas but the liquid instead. So what is the difference between gas and liquid? So in gas, its particles interact very, 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 very weakly and don't almost interact at all, but in the liquid, they interact strongly. So liquid, the system of liquid helium is the system of relatively strongly interacting helium atoms. And if they interact so strongly, then any low-lying excitations will have the spectrum for phosons. And this is what was observed experimentally. So the importance of this formula when it was initially derived is that in the smoothly interpolate between the dispersion law for phonons and the dispersion law for free particles.
But here we consider the phonon particle interaction, right?
Hmm? Here we consider?
No, this is omega k is generally the photon and the phonon and the particle interaction, right?
What do you mean?
No, this is the phonon interaction and the excitation, right?
This is the phonon excitation arising as a result of interaction between the particles, yes.
Yeah, but in our model of the superfluid and the superconductivity, we don't consider the phonon case.
Why we don't?
I mean, the persistence current or whatever in our discussion in the lectures.
We don't consider the phonon case, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. These are just excitations. No, for persistent current, we don't consider.
This does not appear in the lecture.
Yeah, no. No, pretty persistent current. Pretty persistent compared to this. So superfluid. Yeah. So it occurs if this phase varies smoothly in space, then in this case when you have the persistent superfluid current.
I mean, in this case, what's the role of phonon play in superfluidity or superconductivity?
Okay. They determine the heat capacity at low temperatures.
Okay.
Heat capacity. So in the past when they considered superfluidity, people measured heat capacity and found the behavior with respect to temperature consistent with the fact that the lowest excitations are. So can you concern the persistent current? So then therefore the phonons don't. Okay, probably it's a good time to stop. I will be up for some Monday, you can ask me any questions about it.
Righty, let's bomb this cookie. So I gave you, everybody has a couple of topics. And basically the core of the course, it's almost the whole course, because the whole course was very important, and without knowing these things which are written here, you will not be able to understand the second part of the course. So for that part of the thing. This classical field theory, so basically everything about Lagrangians, how to derive field equations from the Lagrangian, if you have symmetry of the Lagrangian or the action, how to construct the current, construct current through the Noether's theorem. A special such current can be energy momentum tensor. How to go to the Hamiltonian in the simplest case of the scalar field. How to quantize the Hamiltonian using the canonical quantization rules. And then, so you mentioned different fields, so you going from scalar fields to fermions. Well, you should know that while fermions exist, it's nothing else than the massless Dirac equation. You don't need to know much about that. You should know what helicity is, because it's an important quantity. You should know everything about Dirac equation. And then maybe some, what I mean by, for example, gamma matrix gymnastics is that you should know what phase of gamma mu is, for example. Or more complicated, what gamma mu, gamma nu is, or gamma mu, gamma nu, gamma lambda is, and so on. So these things are important. You should know that there exist some relations like UUY to P slash plus N. And so on. So basically, the Dirac part is very, very important.
Yes.
trace properties, you mean know as in know how to show it, or know it from heart, by heart?
Well, you will probably not be asked to derive anything except Feynman rules. So, if you don't remember the formula, I'll give it to you. So don't try to memorize complicated formulas. That's not the purpose. The purpose is like to understand that actually, for example, what is written here is not an upper but a matrix, and so on. So, okay, and then it would be nice if you remember the formulas for propagators, because that's the very basic thing, the very heart of the PLT. But again, if you don't remember it exactly, you know, you use a formula. But once you have the Feynman rules, you should be able to construct the amplitude from there. So, if you draw the diagram, whatever, then you should be able to write what M is, for example, and explain what the terms mean. And then you have these interacting fields. So some basic understanding what local gauge invariance is and what it gives us. And there are some examples of interacting fields. Dimensional analysis in field theory would be my favorite question, so look at that. And then you should know what the green function is. You should know what the Wicks theorem is, and you should know how these concepts are connected to Feynman diagrams. Scalaring amplitudes you should be able to construct from the Feynman rule. All I want you to know about cross sections is that they depend on m squared. So you don't need to memorize any complicated formula for the cross section, whatever. You should know that there's something like phase based, but the formula is not important for us. But you should know that the dynamics depends on m squared. That's important. And QED, you should probably remember the Lagrangian for QED, because it's the most fundamental Lagrangian in nature. Questions to this?
For the cross section?
Yes.
We calculate the total cross section. If the two bosons are identical, we get a factor of 1 over 2.
Yeah, I don't know why.
But is it the same for the fermions?
I don't think so. I don't know. Well, it's probably derived from the student Schrader, I guess. Or at least mentioned somewhere. But you know, at this point, we don't care what factors 1/2, 2, whatever, 32, pi. I just want you to, you know, understand the general structure, that I can draw some diagrams and I can read from there something the dynamics of the process. But you know, I'm not really. You should know that you should, if you have two ways of drawing the diagram, that you either add or subtract the amplitudes. You should know that. But yeah. Yeah, fermion, for example, if you exchange, then you subtract. If you have fermion going out like that, or the other possibility is going like that, then the amplitudes are subtracted. So there's one amplitude here, and another there. So you subtract these amplitudes. So there's an interference between these two amplitudes, these calculated probabilities. Questions?
Why do you subtract them and not add them?
It's simply because you have fermionic statistics. So there's something weird about fermions, that's why it's not present. Yeah, it has to do with the fermion statistics. Okay. Yes?
During one particular tutorial, we were asked to compare the scattering amplitudes of, was it plus E minus or E minus? I suppose it doesn't really matter, but we're asked to compute scattering amplitudes and compare with the Born amplitude for the electro right. Electric potential classical. Well, not really classical, but anyway, I was asking if you could show us how to determine the sign in general of the diagram relative to that.
Well, I don't have material out, so you're just simply to calculate a diagram.
No, I mean, if you're given a diagram, can you figure out what its sign is relative to the Born amplitude of the electric potential?
I have a ball.
So how to show whether a diagram is attractive or repulsive then?
Well, what you have to do is actually you have to calculate the amplitude. This is only valid in non-relativistic approximation. So for then you have to do non-relativistic approximation. So it was done on the lecture basically. So what we have done on the lecture for QED kind of like electron scattering. Yeah, so you have to follow all the steps, and in the end you see you have plus or minus sign there. But I don't think you can immediately read it from the famous diagram. Well, you can understand it physically, right? If I have two electrons, they probably repel each other.
What I mean is there's one sign which seems to be determined by the, I suppose you could say, parity of the diagram.
For fermions.
Yes, I mean like the whole crossing diagram there. I'm asking.
Oh, very good. So, in the derivation which we had on the lecture, we just had very geometrical description. So, in the derivation, you really considered sigma b to be pi r b squared, which is the geometrical cross section, right? But it's only true if there is no like interaction on distance. So, it's only really if I send a particle and makes a hole in my in the blackboard, then the cross section is besides the distance here. But once actually the blackboard can push my particle at the distance not before actually touching the blackboard, I get an effective cross section, which is usually much bigger than the geometric one. So if you have some forces which can actually so that electromagnetic force, for example, then the electron coming to another one, it feels it much earlier than actually they touch, right? Because there's an electric field. So the effective cross section will be much bigger. In the derivation which we had, it was like a derivation using fingers, right? So it was very simplistic derivation, but the result is very more generally. But I have to replace this geometric thing by the real cross section, the effective cross section. Yeah.
Okay, so
Yeah.
Okay,
let's go here. Favorite thing. So let me start is, as a matter of numerical relativity. I'll take that. So I'll ask you first numerical relativity. Who think will definitely take it? Raise your hand, please. No.
What?
Numerical relativity, who thinks will definitely take it? So it's 1, 2, 3, 4.
Nothing's definite.
Five. So there's one thing. So this is at the very end of the psi course. So at the time, you'll probably be writing essay. So think about that. You'll be writing essay. So something you should take only courses which help you with the essay, or if you are interested in the, if you think you can apply it in the future. And that's the one for course. Okay. So once more. So definitely yes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's say 5.5. 6. Okay. Maybe say it. And please don't vote again if you have already voted. 1, 2, 3. Let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Thank you. And definitely not. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, six, seven, eight. Thank you so much. Picture nine. Okay. So now look quantum gravity. Definitely yes. And now we can vote again. So if you want to vote for relativity, you can vote for the quantum gravity as well, because there would be yeah. So one, two, three. Anybody else?
That's it.
Four. And there is almost one more vote, so it's five. Yes, it's five. Maybe the quantum gravity. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. 8, 9, 10, 11. And definitely not. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay.
Yeah, one second. Can I ask you to raise the hand if you definitely would like to take loop quantum gravity? Okay. Three
second more, don't change your one.
Three people, right?
Okay. Okay, very good. Thank you so much. So at this point, it's like 6 and 12 for maybe numerical relativity, and 5 and 11 for quantum gravity. So it's all people, actually. So it doesn't help much. okay, very good. On Monday, it'll be this carrier something. It will be between 10 and probably 11:30. So it'll be John talking to you about how to choose your supervisor for a say. It will be probably some of the PI, from the PI faculty talking to you about how to choose an essay, how to apply for PhD, where to apply for PhD, how your application should look like, and so on. So, you know, if you are a little bit interested in this, it's not compulsory, but it's mostly recommended for you to come.
What is this?
Yeah.
And that will be Monday here, Monday 10 to 11:30. And I hope, has anybody looked in the calendar? It's already on your calendar. Yeah, very good. So, and we don't know who will be talking, so it will be definitely John. There'll be definitely followers here. Not all of them, not some of them. And there'll be somebody from PI faculty, but we don't know who yet. Okay. Oh, and if you have still more questions, feel free to ask and
thank you. Just a question. Forgive me a question about voice.